Welcome everyone to today's CLUIN seminar. My name is Jean Dallas. I'm here with the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. I'll be helping to moderate today's CLUIN seminar, which has been sponsored by the University of Washington Superfund Research Program. Today's session will look at opportunities for bringing rapidly emerging technologies to revolutionize modeling of chemical contaminants in coastal waters. This is going to be a live broadcast of an actual presentation that's happening to a real audience out in Region 10, and we've gotten the okay to go ahead and move along. They're ready to begin. So I will begin and start the official introductions for today's session. As I was mentioning earlier, for today's CLUIN seminar, I would ask that all of our remote participants be sure that they have a copy of the presentation materials open in front of them today. If you haven't done so, you can find those materials on the CLUIN seminar homepage, which you would have been directed to once you signed up for today's session. Those materials, along with a complete description for today's session, contact information, and bios for the presenters as well as our hosts, will be available on CLUIN indefinitely. So you can either click a button that says Go to Seminar and look at the slides online in a web browser, or alternatively, you can download a PowerPoint or PDF copy of those slides. Everyone should have the slides open and be looking at the first slide, which is slide number one, our title slide. I'll ask everyone to turn the page and move on to slide number two. And if you haven't guessed it, that's how our sessions will work. Each individual participant is going to manually move through the materials at our verbal cues. So again, I'm on slide number two, our housekeeping slides. All of the telephone lines for our participants have been muted and will remain muted until we get to the break for Q&A with our presenter. At that time, you'll be able to hit star 6 to unmute your line and ask a question out loud if you're on the telephones. We would ask, though, that you remain muted until we get to that break in the presentation. Don't put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that could be disruptive. As far as Q&A, as I mentioned, we will have an opportunity to ask questions. The audience in the room will be able to ask a question directly to our presenter. Those of you that are calling in or remotely listening to the streaming audio can actually type up your comments or questions online, and you may do so at any time. When we get to that appropriate break for Q&A, I'll be able to read the questions out loud on your behalf for our presenter to answer. So if you're looking for the option to answer those questions in electronically, I'll direct you to take a look at some of the icons you see along the top of your slides. If you're viewing the slides in a web browser window, you'll see numbered links that appear on the left-hand side to help you navigate through the materials. You'll also see orange icons at the very top. The single arrow pointing to the right will advance one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. You'll also see towards the right a question mark icon. If you click that, as long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, a new window will open up, which will allow you to type up your questions or comments electronically. You can also use that very same question mark form to let us know if you're having any technical problems. We simply ask you to include a phone number so we can reach out and help troubleshoot your issue. Again, you can ask questions or make comments at any point in time electronically. You don't have to wait. We would encourage you to do that early so we can build up a queue and get through as many questions as possible. I want to remind everybody that today's session is being recorded and will automatically be archived on the CLUIN website. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, and as soon as that archive is available, everyone who signed up will automatically get the email to let you know how to access the recording. If you're interested, you can take a look at the over 450 events we already have archived up there on the CLUIN webpage on the URL shown on slide two. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for everyone today. So I'm going to ask everybody to move along to slide number three, which is the beginning of the technical material. And I'm going to turn things over to Katie Frevert out there in Region 10, who's a program manager at the University of Washington. Katie?
Hi, thank you. I'm working in the Research Translation Corps of the University of Washington Superfund Research Program, and I wanted to first express our appreciation to EPA Region 10 for hosting the UW Agency Seminars. This series has been helpful to provide the opportunity for agency professionals to interact with scientific researchers on topics that they find are both timely and relevant. As background, just a bit of background, our Superfund Research Program is part of a network of university grants funded by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. The federally funded program applies a multiple disciplinary approach to research with its goal to provide a solid research foundation from which environmental managers and risk assessors can draw in their work related to Superfund and other hazardous waste sites. There are 18 universities across the country with Superfund research programs, In our region, EPA Region 10, both the University of Washington and Oregon State University have active programs. I invite you to learn more about the range of research done by the Superfund Research Program online. Before I introduce Dr. Baker, I want to point out that we are asking the audience here in Seattle and the fluent audience to fill out a short feedback form. At the end of the session, your input helps inform our future seminars. And on the last slide, you'll see that there's a clue and appreciate your direct feedback as well. So, Dr. Baker, among other things, is the director of the Puget Sound Institute, which is a product of a cooperative effort between the University of Washington, the US EPA, and the Puget Sound Partnership. The Institute serves as a bridge between the scientific community and those charged with restoring and protecting the Puget Sound. He has co-authored over 90 papers on contaminant cycling in the Great Lakes, Chesapeake Bay, and coastal waters. He was a lead author on a scientific review of PCBs in the Hudson River, and he is an ex officio member of the Puget Sound Partnership, which he chaired from 2007 to 2009. As this is just a snapshot of his experience, we were asked recently by Region 10 to seek out University of Washington faculty with expertise in research and restoration work that is applicable for their work, particularly in the Puget Sound. We compiled a list from a range of scientific fields at the university, spanning schools and departments. Joel Baker caught the eye of our agency partners. His name came immediately to the top of the list. Joel, thank you very much for coming.
Okay, thank you very much, Katie, and thanks to Gene for setting this up. Just a quick sound check, Gene, can you hear us okay?
You sound perfect.
Okay, great, and we're on my title slide. So welcome to all of you. It's always a little disconcerting to broadcast things up to a wide group of people that don't know who's on the other end of the phone, but having said that, I welcome the opportunity to speak to you today. My perspective coming into this when I was asked to give this lecture, I had just in my morning commute realized somebody had said the date on the radio, and I realized that I was celebrating, for lack of a better term, the 30th anniversary of the first time I collected a water sample and measured PCBs, 1982 in the middle of Lake Superior as part of my graduate work. And in some ways it didn't seem like it was 30 years, but in many ways it seems like it's been 100 years. So that kind of informed what I thought I would discuss with you today. And I want to say that my goal here is to be a bit provocative and to be a bit and to entertain some thoughts on all of our parts. The Puget Sound Institute, as Katie mentioned, is a program between the University of Washington and EPA, and it along with the Superfund Research Center and other efforts are all working hard at this common refrain of we need to have better communication between the academic scientists and the agency scientists. And I certainly recognize that the agency and the regulatory environment is a different world than the academic environment, but therefore has different approaches and different constraints. But I would hope you agree that we're both grounded in the desire to continually improve our science and to bring that science to bear on important issues. So that's the underlying theme of this, and the overall message here is that I think we need to continually make sure that we're asking that really hard question of do we have the right mechanisms in place to translate new work that's being done not only at the universities but at the EPA regional or EPA research labs and indeed worldwide. Is that new information getting incorporated into the tools that are being used by not only EPA but the other resource management agencies and regulatory agencies? So that's the broad overview of the talk. Let's go on then to the second slide. Doesn't go to the second slide. Let's see. There we go. Okay, so on to slide two, introduction and perspective. And just to kind of break the ice a little bit, let's go back to 1982. I don't know where you were, but I was just beginning graduate school at the University of Minnesota. That's me in the lower left-hand corner there, obviously. The upper right-hand corner, those of you who have been at the EPA lab in Duluth, Minnesota, will recognize that shot. That is indeed Lake Superior in Duluth, where I did my dissertation research. But the real figure I want to draw your attention to is in the lower right-hand corner. That's a telephone, circa 1982. So those of you who are young may not recognize what those things look like. but I guess if you work in a federal agency, you probably still have those phones in your office, so it's probably okay. But the point is that's what telephones look like. That's what I look like, and that was my study area. If we jump ahead 30 years, next slide, I look a little bit different. 30 years kind of wears you down a little bit. That's me about a year ago. The upper right-hand corner is our research lab. That's the Center for Urban Waters. It's the University of Washington research lab in Tacoma, Washington. Mount Rainier in the background, and of course Puget Sound in the foreground. In the lower left-hand corner, of course, is a telephone. Right? And the message here is that over a 30-year period, I've gotten a little bit older, or a lot older. We still have research labs on water, and we still are interested in the same broad general questions about water, water quality, pollutant fate, and transport. The technology has changed a tremendous amount in 30 years, and I think everyone knows that conceptually. The question on the table for today, though, is, has the technology evolution, particularly in terms of information technology, been translated back into the applications in water quality modeling? So just a little bit, and this is just kind of spun up a little bit. You all know about Moore's Law, this concept of that. And so next slide, the information technology revolution. Just a graph I lifted from the internet from NJ Tech Review. This is a plot of Moore's Law that states that the number of transistors on a CPU is going to double roughly every 2 years, an often quoted statistic. In fact, it held true going back into the 1970s. So on the bottom axis is date, and you can kind of read across there when you first started getting engaged in your professional career. For me, it was in the early 80s, so we had 80, 86 processors. I remember the day we got the first 286 computer. We thought we were in heaven. And then when I started at the University of Maryland in the late 80s, the point of contention at my startup package was whether they were going to spring for a Pentium processor in the computer for my lab. I had to argue with the dean about whether it was worth the extra investment to get the Pentium processor. I remember that distinctly. The number of transistors, of course, that's on a log scale, so there has been an exponential increase in computer power, and I don't think I need to make that case to anyone. That's very well established. In fact, it's so good, we take it for granted now. If we go on to the next slide, the other thing, of course, and again, this is all obvious stuff to get the conversation started, is not only are our computers faster, but they're all connected together. So the very fact we're having this seminar broadcast around the country in real time is something we couldn't have done in 1980 or 1990 or 2000, in fact. We may not be doing it now. Hopefully we're doing it now. So on the left-hand side is a cool, looks like abstract art, and in fact it is the 2010 map of the global internet put together by Cisco systems, and the point being that we're really are a global information exchange system now. The figure on the right-hand side is just the increase in bandwidth. And again, this is preaching to the choir. I'm sure we're getting faster, we're more connected than we ever have been before. And again, the reason I'm going through all this is that the question is going to be, are we keeping up? Are we taking advantage of this networking and bandwidth in our approach to water quality modeling? The other thing that is now become so common that it's on all of our phones, and you may not even think about it, is real-time data streaming. Okay, so this is I went on to the next slide. There's a map with some green lines on it. This is the Google real-time map from whenever I did these slides yesterday or the day before, which gave you in the middle of the night. And the point is now we get real-time information on the traffic patterns in our region. We can look at an area and say, is the traffic green? Green is good, red is bad. And this is all data being streamed in somewhere, being processed, and being ported out to your cell phones in real time. So, and that's interesting as a sort of communication tool. It's certainly useful if you're a driver. You can look at this and say, there's traffic on I-5. I don't want to leave for work. Or I don't want to come home from work. I can detour around things. But think of this as if you're a transportation engineer. You now have, through this technology, millions of cars out there recording data for you every day, 24 hours a day, and dumping it down somewhere. So if you're asking questions about, sure, today I'm asking a question, can I get to work on time? How long is it going to take me to get to work? But all that information is really telling a transportation engineer, where do we need new highways? Where are the pinch points? What's the dynamics of traffic flow? if you're a theoretical mathematician, you can use that data and ask all kinds of really interesting questions about chaos and congestion and all kinds of things. So here's an example where sort of inadvertently, we've tagged everyone in the United States for sure, and many people around the world, with cell phones, right? The cell phones record not only where you are, but if you're into things like Twitter and Foursquare and Instagram, all these things I don't know about, it tells you what your experiences are. It tells you what you're eating, who you're with, what your impressions are, what you think of places, what you're taking pictures of. Think of all that information. So if you're an epidemiologist, if you think about risk and you think about people's exposure, now we've tagged everyone in the United States. I'm pretty sure that if EPA or NIH had proposed to tag everyone in the United States with a little electronic box that we record all their movements, there would have been quite an uprising. In fact, we've done that. So it's a great data set. So traffic is one, but there's much, much other data. Again, the question is there an analog in water quality? You know, do we have things like that in water quality yet, or could we? Okay, so the next slide is, I wanted to stop and go back a little bit, and so the next slide is modeling chemical contaminants in aquatic ecosystems, and maybe just to check in with Jean, are we still tracking okay?
You are just fine.
Okay, great, thanks. So I wanted to go back and review, and this is going to be a biased review because one of my themes that emerged from putting this talk together is that we're all biased to thinking that what happened when we were in graduate school was like the coolest thing ever. And before then, nothing was important, and after then, nothing's really been interesting, right? That's the bias. So that's the bias. I did my graduate work in the Great Lakes on PCBs, so that was the coolest thing ever. But bear with me, let me walk through a couple of things. There really was, and this was led in no small part by EPA scientists, some of the very fundamental work about what we know about how chemicals, and this talk would be specific to PCBs, how chemicals behave in aquatic environments. So everyone knows that KOW is an important parameter to predict how PCBs and other chemicals partition between dissolved and particulate phases and accumulate in organisms. But why does everyone know that? Well, everyone knows that because Sam Perikoff at the Athens lab in the late 70s published this paper that's been cited 1,700 times, I found out yesterday, which is a huge number, sorption of hydrophobic pollutants on natural sediments. Now, it turns out that Sam... You know, the agricultural community had been doing this for a long time prior to that, but he brought it into the aquatic science community. And this paper, next slide is the two graphs, figure 3 and figure 4 from that paper. These are the graphs that launched, you know, a million Superfund site calculations, right? So on the left axis, or the left panel, is the work where so they went had sediments from different rivers around the United States, and they absorbed on the left-hand, this is pyrene, on the left-hand panel, and what they observed, which is what now everyone knows, that organic carbon is important. Okay. So this is a plot of the fraction organic carbon on the x-axis of the sediment itself versus the amount of the pyrene partition coefficient, the distribution, and you get a nice straight line. Okay, cool. Right. Everyone knows that. Everyone knows that because of the work that was done in the mid to late 70. The other thing everyone knows is that if you look across chemicals within a class, that as you increase the octanol water partition coefficient, you increase partitioning. Right? This is the famous KOW plot, and that came out of the work that was done in the late 70s as well. So that was really a substantial contribution that is in every water quality model in existence. Now, the assumption is we are at equilibrium, and the assumption is KOW matters, and the assumption is that the organic carbon content of the solids is the parameter that captures sort of how good the solid is at absorbing things. The other types of modeling exercises that were coming online, sort of coincident with Perikoff's work, were the mass balance models, primarily starting in the Great Lakes, but in other systems as well. And some of the names there are Bob Pohman and Dom DeToro, who at the time were both at Manhattan College, and they put together some of the first mass balance type models that were based on physicochemical processes on a lake-wide scale. The other big name, of course, to mention in this field is Don MacKay, who at the time was at the University of Toronto, and I think hopefully many people graduated and understood the substantial contributions of Don over the years, and it's the Gatsby models and his lake-wide model. And the seminal papers that came out of his group in the late 1980s, so I've got one of the next slide then with the schematic of the so the mass balance in the Mackay paper, Mackay 1989, it's a cartoon of what lake is this? Probably doesn't matter. This is Lake Ontario. It doesn't say though. So figure 5, estimated PCB flows in 1965. Is the slide we're on. But now these are fairly common to pull these kind of mass balance models together, where you look at quantifying loads of, in this case, PCBs to the lake from a whole variety of different sources, internal processing, adsorption and volatilization and onto the sediments and things. This looks an awful lot like a water quality model, right? And these were all put together in the 1980s. The other thing that happened in sort of in parallel and largely by an overlapping group of scientists, and so down to the next slide of the Gobis and Mackay 1988 seminal paper, where they quantified, built a model of dietary bioaccumulation of hydrophobic organic chemicals in fish. Again, this is not the only effort like this. I mean, there's lots of people who were developing similar types of models with fish and with birds and with terrestrial organisms as well. But the idea, if you go on to the next slide, is really codifying the sort of pharmacokinetic model for uptake in organisms. And again, so water quality modeling, environmental chemistry really didn't develop any of this. This is all stolen from other disciplines, right? So if you're from the medical school, this is pharmacokinetics. It's just, instead of just being a person in the cartoon, you turn it into a fish, and it's basically the same idea, right? Some things go in, some things are metabolized, some things are excreted. But really, the point of this is that in the sort of the 70s to 80s into the 90s, a lot of the chassis or the underlying engine of water quality model was developed. And all of those contain certain assumptions. If we move to the present time and ask sort of what are the current off-the-shelf models, I've gone on to the next slide then that talks about current models. And it's labeled bioaccumulation in aquatox. So this is Dick Park's model, aquatox. Just as an example, there are, and certainly EPA has the WASP series of models as well, but the idea is that the equations, the fundamental processes that are embedded in these models that are being used today were a direct result of the work that was done in the 70s and 80s. So let's move on to the next slide then, which is talks about the New York and New Jersey Harbor CART model. But I really want to ask the question, so, circa, let's say, 1990 or so, that all of the work on PCBs and much of the work on PCB behavior in aquatic ecosystems had been incorporated into water quality models. So, 1990 called up, to the Athens lab to get a water quality model that basically had to the bioaccumulation, it had partitioning between dissolved and particle phases, and it had sort of a mass balance aspect to it. Okay, so that was sort of state of the art at the time. The next step on this is thinking about spatial and temporal complexity. So there was a major effort that went on called the Contaminant Assessment and Reduction Project. This was supported by the harbors, the New York and New Jersey Harbor Port Authority, and was worked on primarily. The modeling work was done by Hydrofoil, Devin Farley et al. At the time, with substantial contributions from the state of New Jersey, state of New York, a bunch of players in this. This was a many-year project to develop a model of the New York-New Jersey harbor, all related to the issue of sediment dredging and driven by the costs, increasing costs of disposal of contaminated sediment. So the question that this model was built to ask was, what are the sources of contaminants to the harbor, to the sediment in New York and New Jersey Harbor? And more specifically, are we dealing with relic contaminations from days gone by in the bottom of the harbor, or are these contaminants there because of current flows? Critically important question, because as the port environmental director pointed out when we started this project, he could go and get as much money as he needed to dredge out the harbor and clean it up. He could do that once. He didn't want to go back every year and ask for $100 million to clean up the harbor. So is this a relic problem we're fixing, or is this an ongoing contamination problem that we're going to have to live with? So that's what the CART model was about. And this was all circa sort of mid-90s going into the early 2000s. And I sort of highlight it for two reasons. One is it's probably, in my view, one of the better attempts to take the existing models that I was just discussing and make them more temporally and spatially explicit and to integrate across different modeling platforms. So the work that was done on the contaminant assessment and reduction model, I'm on the next slide now that has the cartoon, it says modeling framework. What the team led by HydroQual was able to do, and this was, you know, lots and lots of people worked on this, was to marry together, to stitch together a number of different projects, starting from the left with ECOM, the hydrodynamic fluid transport, so this is sort of classic engineering modeling. You know, step one, get the water moving around, right? Step two, ECOM said, get the sediment moving around, right? Step three, get the organic carbon cycle, right, so using RCA Utro. For that, step four, get the toxic chemicals moving right, and each of these builds on the other, right? I mean, the assumption here, the premise of this approach to modeling, is that if you don't get the hydrodynamics right, you're not going to get the sediment right. If you don't get the sediment right, you're not going to get the carbon right. If you don't get the carbon right, you're not going to get the toxics right. If you don't get the toxics right, you don't get the food chain right. So it's either a very rational way to proceed, or it's a house of cards, depending on your perspective. But this was really an attempt to pull together all these models, and I do think it was really quite successful, and I had the privilege of chairing their external advisory panel for this project on the modeling side for a number of years. So one of the things that you hear a lot about modeling chemical contaminants, the next slide is a grid of, you may or may not recognize that Long Island in the center and sort of New York, Hudson River coming down from the north. This is a model grid of the CARP model. One of the things you hear about contaminant modeling is you can't do it at a highly resolved scale because it's so complicated that you can't do the fine scale modeling. You can't do multiple box modeling. So this is the CARP grid, and if we go to the next slide, and the reason it goes out into the ocean is you have to go out in the ocean in order to get the hydrodynamics right. And so we're modeling really interested in questions in and around New York Harbor, but the model demand had to be much larger than that in order to get the All right. If you go to the next slide, which is just simply a blow-up of the previous slide, this is the gridding of the CARP model in and around New York. It's a bit boxy, as models tend to be, but if you're thinking about New York for a moment, maybe you can pick up Manhattan. I'll point to people here. Manhattan Island is there, and the Battery Park, and the New Jersey River systems are captured in the model. This model was used quite successfully, I think, to address the question of the Port of New York and New Jersey. If you go to the next slide, it's labeled Summary of 2378 TCDD Interim Clean Bed Analysis. This model was used to assess how much of the dioxin and PCBs and PAHs and mercury and all kinds of things, how much of those chemicals in the sediment were coming from current day loads versus historic loads. And that's what I don't want to go into the details, but that's what this figure shows. In the short version, and not surprising to anyone who works on dioxins in the New York region, is that most of the dioxin is coming from historic loads. The current loads are pretty small. Relative to the historic loads, just leave it at that. But the point is that this model is really complicated. There's tens of thousands of boxes in the grid, and it was run over multiple year periods, and this was all done in the early 2000s. So let's go back onto the next slide then, which is a replot of Moore's Law. And let's just kind of, I've added some arrows to it to make the point that, again, starting back in the, when Sam Karikoff was doing his partitioning work in the lab and then incorporating that into models, around 1980, and when Mackay and Gobis and those folks were building these models of bioaccumulation of chemicals in the fish, they were working with computers that had processors on the order of 10,000 to a million transistors per CPU. The CARP program came later, and so that work was being done. And this is a little bit unfair, but CARP was able to really for the first time use parallel processing and doing computer clusters, which was a real advance. But anyway, you kind of get the point. They were working with the tools they had available at the time. And we are now in a different era. We now have tens of thousands, if not millions of times more processors available to us than they had when they built this model. Just as an aside on the CART program, we spent on the advisory panel probably close to a year trying to figure out how to do what they call collapse the model, collapse the hydrodynamic model under the chemical contaminant grid. And the idea was you had to run the hydrodynamic model and the sediment transport model at a fairly fine grid in order to capture all the dynamics in something as complex as the New Jersey harbor system. But you couldn't possibly model PCBs or dioxins at that scale because it would melt your computers, right? You couldn't do it. It never worked. And in about the year we spent a lot of deliberations, consultant interviews and things. I remember quite clearly a meeting in New York, and we were discussing this and trying to figure out the idea is to take these finely scaled results and you combine them together and make a coarser grid. And there's all kinds of mathematical problems you run into in doing that. And about after lunch, midway into this meeting, some, frankly, fairly young people in the back of the room stood up and said, "Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this?" We said, "Well, you can't possibly model this, is it?" "Yes, we can. We have this new cluster thing. We're going to buy us like 5 PCs, we'll hook them all together, and we'll run it." And the rest of us went, "Wow, that's really cool. We didn't know you could do that." So that's the CART story. And so one part of the message is, people running your computer should be substantially younger than you. Which becomes easier and easier as you are. So the premise of the talk for today, and so I moved on to the next slide, is that the tools to model contaminant behavior and effects in aquatic ecosystems have not kept up with the information revolution. And that's not really a criticism of all of us. It's hard to keep up with things that are moving really quickly. But that means there's an opportunity in front of us to really think hard about how we're going to incorporate some of this stuff. Next slide are the corollaries. I've already mentioned this, and I'm guilty of the first one for sure. Both in terms of computers and it turns out in terms of analytical chemistry, I think many of us are sort of stuck with the assumption that whatever we had in grad school is what we have now. Right? I fell into this trap in analytical chemistry. I run a lab, we have really high-end analytical instrumentation that can do stuff I can't even imagine how we would use it. It's so much more sensitive and so much more stable than what I'm used to working with. So when I'm faced or presented with questions or studies, I go back to, what could we do in 1985? Which is really kind of a problem. So that's something to think about. The second bullet on this slide labeled corollaries is that, and this sort of gets to this issue about how do you innovate and experiment in a world where for regulatory purposes and for practical purposes, you need to be stable and confident in your products. Right? There's always going to be that dynamic tension. So there's this idea that, I think it's kind of crept into the modeling world where we don't want to develop new models. We've got these models, we've got them locked down, they've been verified, they've gone through court, right, we're done. Right? Don't, as an academic, don't come in and say, "Yeah, but I can make the model a little bit better." I think we fall into that here a little bit, and I understand it, but it's kind of like, we went from DOS to Windows. Everyone lives through that. There has to be an environment, there has to be an environment where we can do both simultaneously. So let's go on to the next slide. But now you're probably thinking, if you're a practitioner, wait a minute, am I just trying to drum up work for the academics? My model's fine. What's this guy trying to do? So what are we missing in the current models? The current models assume we're at equilibrium with respect to partitioning. They assume that all fish behave the same, and they're all bags of lipid, more or less. Gobus and Mackay. And we're missing some other things that we should talk about. And the point is, the reason we're missing them early on is that we didn't have the computer horsepower to run those models and didn't make any sense to build models you couldn't run, and we didn't have the data. We didn't have any way of collecting the data that was spatially and temporally consistent with the models. Let's work through a couple of examples, and then we'll get back to that. So one of the books we use in my class, and maybe hopefully many people are familiar with this, but going on to the next slide with the spherical cow. John Hart's book, which is really kind of a fun little book. If you don't know it, you should look at it. And so consider a spherical cow. It's about approximating solutions in environmental problems. Right. So if you're an engineer or you're a physicist, the first thing you do is whatever it is, you assume it's a sphere.
So this whole book is about, you know, consider a spherical towel. And they look at the right hand where we do have, in fact, a spherical towel. Then we do things like, you know, get the tail still hanging out. Well, in the limit, as the tail goes to zero, right, makes the math easier. So we do that kind of stuff all the time. And that's fine. But it's important to remember that towels aren't spheres. Right? So when you get to the end, you need to constantly be going back and asking yourself that question. So let's talk about the non-spherical towels in the world of water quality modeling. I've gone on to the next slide now, phase partitioning in the water column. The work that Karakoff did and many, many others have done on phase partitioning and KOW relationships with carbon and all that kind of stuff are absolutely true. If you're at equilibrium and you're dealing with sediments or dealing with solids that are fairly uniform in their composition. Right? I mean, there's been thousands of master students who have absorbed some chemical onto some solid and got a partition coefficient. But let's look in the water column. And we've done, over the 30 years, done lots of measurements in different systems of phase partitioning in the water column. So then on to the next slide that has a picture of beautiful, you can pick that out, Baltimore, Maryland, from a boat. So when I was at the University of Maryland before moving to the University of Washington, we did a lot of field studies of partitioning of things like PCBs and pHs in a water column. In places like Baltimore Harbor, which is a reasonably contaminated urban system. And over the years, there's been all these theories to explain why the data don't fit a simple KOW partitioning relationship. We went through the exercise of saying, well, it's three-phase partitioning, colloids. My whole dissertation was about colloid partitioning in my superior. We'll get into whether or not that's a good explanation or not. There was a raft of information that came out of Deb Swackhammer's lab at the University of Minnesota and other places about, well, maybe the disruption kinetics in the water column is slow, particularly in productive systems. You're growing algae so fast that the disruption rates are slow enough that the algae, you're making algae faster than you're adsorbing chemicals through them, so you're in disequilibrium. And then finally, later, there was this idea coming out of Dick Lucy's lab at Stanford and Upal Ghosh at University of Maryland and others about there's these highly sorbent particles or soot particles and things like that in sediments that are highly sorbent. So let me just briefly walk you through. A little bit of data to explore these ideas. So I've gone on to the next slide, which is a plot of the log KOW versus the log of the distribution coefficient for a whole bunch of field data from Chesapeake Bay, mostly from Baltimore Harbor. And you should be seeing some black dots and some red dots, and you should realize that there's no there's a lot of spread here. Right? So we have orders of magnitude, so we have one column of dots, and the red are PCBs and the black ones are PAHs. And if you look at our column of numbers, you see that there are 3, 4, 5 orders of magnitude variation in the partitioning behavior in the water column of that chemical in a realized system. Now you might say, well, we're just lousy chemists or we're lousy samplers or this is just noise. I'll pass up to making mistakes and not being overly precise, but 3 orders of magnitude I think is real. These are real variations in the water column. That didn't work very well at all, did it? The next slide. Next slide is not showing well on our screen, so I'm going to move on to the next one, which is also not, they're all messed up. Okay. So I'm going to skip. Jean, can you verify that your slides are not showing well as well?
Well, our slides are coming up okay. Are you worried about the granularity in the image?
No, ours are like completely off the screen. Like I can't see them. So you're going to have to help me here. So I'm on the plot that is KOW versus KD, and there's red and black dots.
Okay.
Okay, and if the next slide, do you see anything?
Bear with me one moment. The slide number for me.
I don't think I have the slide number in front of me.
Gene, this is Justin. I believe that slide 31 is frequency and log KD on the other axis.
Yes, thank you.
It's a bunch of blue bars, yeah. The pyrene N equals 119.
Yes, so you can see it?
Yes, we can, no problem.
All right. Sorry, people on scale can't see it, but trust me, it's a fabulous graph. and I have it on my computer here so I can see it, but they can't see it.
So what it is showing is so I've just taken that data that I just showed you, and so for pyrene, you pick one chemical, and I did a frequency distribution of what the distribution coefficients are. And you can imagine from the spread of data that they range several orders of magnitude. There is a central tendency of about 10 to the 4th, so on average, it kind of looks like the KOW plot, but there's lots of real variability. So that's what that slide is. The next slide, which you're also not going to see here in Seattle, is the same data plotted a different way. It's the fraction of the pyrene in the water that's in the dissolve phase. Right? So at least it's passed through a filter, so it may be colloidal or something, but let's not worry about that. It's not particulate. It's not going to settle. And I put this here to make the point that oftentimes we fall into this trap of thinking if things are really hydrophobic, I mean, pyrene's pretty hydrophobic, it's all on the solid. Right? The dissolve phase doesn't matter. The dissolve phase does matter because, A, there's a lot of it as a fraction of the total, and B, if you're thinking about effect, the pyrene, dissolved pyrene is a lot more bioavailable than particulate. And it doesn't settle to the bottom. So sorry for the confusion on the slides here. The next slide, which you also can't see here in Seattle, but hopefully is, and I'll just skip this one because it makes the same point. We've done a lot of analysis on these data to try to figure out if there was some kind of systematic error. The plot that says investigating the sources of variability and partitioning is a residual plot of that previous data. There's no trend with KOW. It doesn't look like we're missing, or between PCBs and PAHs. It really doesn't look like there's a systematic error there. So, okay. Now we're back to the slides we can see in Seattle. We're on to the investigating the sources of variability and partitioning. One, the presence of colloids. And this is a paper by Larry Burkhart at the EPA Duluth Lab, which summarizes, there's a whole bunch of work that's been done over the years on this idea that maybe a lot of what we're calling dissolved PCB or pH is not really dissolved. It's bound up by natural organic matter. And that certainly happens. Is it quantitatively important? Oh, I can see the previous slide. Okay. If you go to the next slide, which is the data from, again, going back to the original, the data set I was showing earlier from Baltimore Harbor, just as an example. On the left-hand panel is a cumulative frequency distribution plot of dissolved organic carbon. And on the right-hand panel is the suspended solids concentration for the same data. And the point to be made here is that the dissolved organic carbon doesn't vary that much in these systems. I mean, it varies. 70% of the values are between 3.5 and 5.5 milligrams per liter. We're looking for orders of magnitude variation in partitioning. So unless the nature of that dissolved organic matter is varying wildly, and we don't think that it is, it's unlikely that the variance that we're seeing in partitioning behavior from place to place and day to day in estuarine water is driven by variations in dissolved organic carbon. So colloid partitioning does happen, but the magnitude, we think, is not the explanation for the variance we're seeing in partitioning. If we go on the next slide, we investigated, and this was a paper, I should send references. This is a paper that was published about a year ago by one of my PhD students. They're really elegant series of experiments investigating the question of whether or not the adsorption of PCBs onto algae is slow enough to cause this equilibrium. I won't go into the details of it, but suffice it to say, the laboratory study with pure culture of algae, and we used a gas system to deliver thermodynamically dissolved PCBs to the algae, which allowed us on the next slide then, which is a plot of time on the x-axis and concentrations of PCBs in the algae on the y-axis for, 10 different PCB congeners. You can sort of see classic first-order uptake kinetics. So we measured those rates in the lab. And the next slide then is a plot of the uptake rate constant of the PCBs versus the optimal water partition coefficient, just to spread the data out. And as you might expect from first principles for a diffusion-limited process, that as you increase the optimal water partition coefficient, you're increasing the size of the molecule, the uptake rate constant in these units increases because there's a bigger driving force. Notice that the uptake rate constant flattens out at the top. The big guys, we think, are now diffusion-limited getting into the cell. But the real point of that, if we go on to the next slide, is if we just look at the data from those laboratory experiments and plot them the way we would field data, so now I'm on the plot with these black and red data points, KOW versus the observed log of KOC. What we can see is that the, for all practical purposes on a log-log plot, the algae reach equilibrium, or what looks pretty close to equilibrium, within about 15 minutes or so. So there is some interesting dynamics of the uptake, but frankly, it's kind of an academic exercise to tease that out. For all practical purposes, the algae are reaching equilibrium fast enough that it doesn't explain the variation we see in field partitioning. Note also that as with the uptake rate constants, there is a flattening out. So for the super hydrophobic PCB congeners, there is limits to their uptake. So we don't think algae partitioning is slow enough to account for the changes we saw in partitioning. And then finally, the last slide in this in this investigation is, well, what about the types of particles? Right? Remember, I said in Karakoff's work and sort of in the theory of this, we're assuming the sorptive nature of the particles is the same for this entire batch of particles you have. This is a plot of the suspended solid concentration versus the fraction. It's labeled twice. It's inconsistent. It's actually the fraction of the plankton. Sorry about that. This should not say pyrene on the y-axis. So this is the based on chlorophyll measurements, how much of the particles in Baltimore Harbor on those samples were plankton versus other stuff, resuspended sediment or eroded clays and things of that nature. And you can see it varies all over the place in terms of the plankton. What we think is happening is, so about the time we were doing this work, with this idea of supersorbing particles came into being. It's kind of an obvious point in retrospect that there are things in the water column and there are things in the sediment that are really good at absorbing these chemicals, primarily things like soot particles and coal tar particles and things of that nature. Upal Ghosh and Dick Luthi and others have spent a fair bit of time working on this issue. So our best estimate right now is what's happening in the water column in estuaries, and we have no reason to think this is just the Chesapeake, is that the partitioning behavior, the variability of partitioning behavior, is being driven by the relative composition of different types of particles. As you get into a situation where you're heavily influenced by a lot of soot particles or a lot of runoff from maybe a coal tar type of situation, you get fundamentally different partitioning behavior. What that means is we need to model those particles. Right? We can't just assume all the particles are the same, and we need to be able to track different classes of particles in our water quality models. Now, we used to not do that because that was really hard to do. Right? I mean, WASP has still three particle types, and those three particle types, and I love WASP, don't get me wrong, WASP is a very useful model, but usually those three particle types are what? Algae, detritus, and clays. And you can change it, but that's usually what we do. What we're saying from the field observations is we need to be keeping track of a lot more different types of particles in order to get the phase partitioning right. Now, that's bad news. I mean, simple is not working for us. We need more complicated. But the good news is, remember the Moore's Law. We've got lots of computers who can throw at this now, so it helps on the way. All right, so that just summarizes. I'm on the next slide now that summarizes those points I made about phase partitioning in the water. And I think in the interest of time, I'm going to move on and not read those to you. And move on to another non-spherical cow, which is the interaction among particles. So the other big assumption in a lot of the, virtually all of the water quality models, is that particles don't talk to each other in the water column. They don't interact. They just kind of go along their merry way. And we know from lots and lots of measurements made in marine systems, and estuarine systems in particular, that that's not true. That if you actually go out and look at water, you find that the flocculation, so I'm on the slide that says physical characteristics of the flock, and has a micrograph of a marine snow particle, the stuff is sticky, and it all clumps together. It's a mess. By and large, the water column is not populated by a bunch of discrete particles. Our models are, but the real water column contains a lot of flocculent material. So we've spent a fair bit of time thinking about what the implications of flock formation are on PCB and other chemical partitioning in the water column. It does a couple of things for you. It scavenges light settling particles, right? So you get this flocculation behavior as a well-known way to remove fine-grained sediments from the water column. That's how we treat water for drinking water. And wastewater as well. If you think about PCB particles, so maybe we're resuspending contaminated sediments, they get incorporated into a big flock like this, and maybe that protects them from diffusing the PCBs out of the water, or off the sediment into the water column, maybe sort of forming this glob where you may not have diffusion through this as well. So there's lots of reasons to think the flocculation it not only affects the transport of particles, but it affects the adsorption-desorption rates of the sediments. Again, the good news is about flocculation is that engineers have known about flocculation for 150 years, going all the way back to the Shmuel-Lakowski equation in 1923, I think it is. There's a lot of theory behind this. At the time, this was a paper from Charlie O'Malley's lab at Hopkins in the, well, I guess it was at North Carolina at the time, 1971. So, you know, the theory of this has been worked out for a long time. The problem has always been it's been really tough to model because of you have to really keep track of hundreds and hundreds of different sized particles in a numerical model. And we didn't have the computer capacity to do that. We do now. So I've had a PhD student graduate a couple of years ago who built, really based on O'Malley's original model from the 70s, built a model that simulated flocculation in the water column, kept track of, I think it was 65 different sized particles, ranging from 2 microns to 1 millimeter. Used, Amelia's flocculation model. I'm onto the text of the slide now about flocculation and PCB. But basically we took Charlie's equations, put them into the model, and now we could track them because of the computer power we had available to us. Winter work, his group has done a lot of work on the porosity and settling velocity of flocks in estuarine systems, so we pulled his stuff in. And then we looked at the PCB mass transfer in and out of the flock particles. I don't have time to go into all the details of it, but the next slide, which is also messed up for us, hopefully not for you, is the, so I've gone to the next slide. It should be a 4-panel figure. It's a little, Gene, can you tell me if you're seeing 4 panels on the?
Yeah, our slides are perfectly fine here online.
Okay. We're not online. I'm gonna blame the locals here, so I'm not going online. But no, so the upper left, so these are experimental results compared to model results. So the experiment, and I'll talk more about it in a second if I have time, is we took sediments from a highly contaminated river in eastern United States, I won't mention it by name, and we in a microcosm experiment, we very gently resuspended the sediment, and we asked questions about what happened to the PCBs. But the first panel on the upper left-hand, the lower left-hand panel just shows the suspended solid concentration. You can't see it here locally, but the suspended solid concentration in the water versus time during a resuspension experiment. You can imagine we started with clean water, we put bottom shear on, and we resuspended and eroded up to maybe, what does that look like, maybe 60 milligrams per liter suspended solids in the water column. The interesting thing about this is because we both measured in the water column using a laser diffraction device and modeled the particle size distribution. The upper left-hand slide, which you can't see in here, is this one. This is the total volume concentration in the, of particles in the water. It's sort of the sum of all the, it collapses all the particle size distribution information into a single parameter. But the point is the model was calibrated to match the size distribution of the particles as they were being eroded in real time. And the reason we think that is important is then on the right-hand panel, there's two panels that are with the red data points. This is one PCB congener, PCB 52, for those of you who are fans of PCBs. The top panel is the concentration on the particles in units of mass per unit volume. And you can see as you resuspend contaminated sediments into the water column, you get contaminated particles in the water column. No great surprise there. But the important part is that the bottom panel is the dissolved phase concentration of PCBs that resulted from desorption of PCBs off of the sediment particles, taking into account that the erosion and also the flocculation and the formation of flocks and the desorption from that. So we now have a calibrated model that incorporates the dynamics of flock formation during resuspension events. Okay, so one last thing and then I'll close, or I'll wrap up. There's one other thing that I want to talk about quickly, which is related to what we're just discussing, and that is what happens when you resuspend sediments. And I think for Superfund, this is probably most of your questions. In one way or another, it's probably wrapped up around this question, right? So we have contaminated sediments, and we release them during either natural resuspension events, episodic storm events, or in fact during remediation operations. Are the PCBs released? And I've made this point earlier, but you know, when we were asked to look at the Hudson River situation, one of the things that we were pointed to was the engineering performance standards for dredging volume 2. And the quote, it says, so I'm onto the slide, it says desorption rate. Given the length of time required for PCBs to reach equilibrium for desorption, it is unlikely that there will be large release of dissolved phase PCBs as a result of dredging activities. This is fundamentally incorrect. This is my first principle. That's not true, as I will show you, for a fairly straightforward reason. So we've done experiments to show that there's about a third of the PCBs that are in the sediment that are pretty readily available for desorption. They come off pretty quickly. And it doesn't seem to matter if the sediments have been contaminated for a long time and they've aged or anything. There's an available fraction. So I'm going to skip over the ejector slides. I'm getting a little short on time here. And I'm going to skip over the PCB release from sediment, release from dissolve phase. This is just all, I've already said that. And let's move on to the slide that says methods, : storm tanks. Just to talk briefly about the experiments that we have done. These were done at the University of Maryland a few years ago. Those tanks that you see in that photograph, there's three replica tanks. They have sediment in the bottom and then a cubic meter of clean water on top. And we have an overhead mixing system that re-suspends the sediment. Next slide, and this is the one that's animated, so maybe it's going to work or maybe it's not. It says dissolved PCB 49. On a blue panel. This is just showing you that when you resuspend contaminated sediments into the water column on time scales of a few hours, so you do in fact get release of PCBs into the water column at fairly high concentration. So we move on to the next slide. It summarizes a whole bunch of, a whole PhD dissertation worth of work, is that when you resuspend these sediments, that about 20% of the PCB is released from the sediment into the dissolved phase. And we did a series of experiments where we suspended the sediment, turned off the mixing, let it settle back down again and sit for a while, and resuspended it again. You think if it was a labile fraction that was only available once, that you're kind of washing off that fraction, then you'd reach less. It turns out that doesn't really happen, that if we allow things to rest and then resuspend, we get another release of PCB. So we're getting something like maybe a third to a half of the PCBs released into the dissolve phase. And we know it was the dissolve phase in this experiment because we used solid phase microextraction to measure that. So the next slide says observations, just to kind of bring that point home, is that when we resuspended the sediment at the second point, about 20% of the PCB mass was desorbed into the truly dissolved phase. And these were at very low, 7 milligrams, about 35 milligrams per liter resuspended in the water column. During a dredging operation, you could conceivably get substantially higher concentrations in the water. So we know a fair bit. The next slide, then, is more observations about this. We know, and now we can model, that during resuspension, either natural events or during operation, that you're going to release chemicals in the dissolve phase, and importantly, there's a fine fraction that's released that doesn't settle, even though we turn the mixing off. There was a fraction that, for all practical purposes, never resettled in our tank, and obviously that material is likely to be transported off site. So those are some examples of things that aren't currently in a lot of models, but can be. We've done the modeling, others have done the modeling now, and I think there's an opportunity to have conversations about how to connect that back into the next generation of contaminant transport models. So I'm on to the slide that says lessons learned so far, and I'm going to wrap up here very quickly. And these are actually lessons out of the CART modeling program. And I kind of add them because it's nice to finish up because a couple of people who I was quite fortunate early in my career to kind of sit in the room and talk to these folks about modeling. So when the CART program started, Bob Toman was one of the lead investigators of it. He's nearing retirement, and those of you who know Bob, when he retired, he actually retired. But the last thing he said leaving the room was, don't make me come back here and fix the loading estimates. So the point is, you can have all the models in the world you want, but you got to get the loading straight, right? Doesn't matter how fancy your model is. So that's something that I always bear in mind. The CART program went down, those of you know Dominic Cattaro, and it's going to be a bit of a firebrand sometimes. The CART model is going down this road of, we've got to get the sediment transfer right. So I'm putting a bunch of money into sediment transport modeling. And those of you who know modelers, they can do this for a very long time. Modeling a lot of sand transport, that was important to them, get the sand right. And finally, Dominic had to say, look, the sediment transport is a sideshow. It's important, it's not that important. Let's move on to the rest of the modeling. Another thing that came out of the CART program, which is just good general advice, is that if you can't model something, if you're
If your supervisor or your client comes to you with a problem and you can't give them model results the next morning, that model is nothing useful. So whatever it is you do, no matter how complicated the modeling is, how complicated the, how long it takes to run, you need some way to distill that back down into a tool so they can generate results the next day. And there's lots of good thinking about how to do that, how to do some pre-processing and things of that nature. And then the final point on this slide is that complex systems require continual review, which is a plug for the kind of, you know, building inspector type of model where, you know, one of the difficulties, one of the criticisms of building complicated models is nobody understands the way it works. Right, and you can't see all the, all the lines of code. No one understands the whole thing. So you need people with a critical eye on it at all times, so that at the end of the day, you have confidence in the model that you generate. So I think I only have one more slide. Labeled final thought. How's that? So the things in italics are things that people always say when you talk to them about making better models. And I just want to push back on a few of them. So complex models are too expensive to develop and run and too slow to be useful. I heard this at a meeting that last week. And I won't mention any more names, but it's just, oh my God, we can't possibly build this complicated model because it's too slow, too expensive. We don't have time to do it. Right? Well, Moore's Law. Yeah, Moore's Law is going to win all the time. And then people say, well, Moore's Law is eventually going to flatten out, right? But you get to the point where you get to the atomic scale, you can't possibly continue to exponentially increase computer power. Well, last week in Australia, many of you saw it in the popular press that they've developed silicon qubits. Right? So what the heck is a silicon qubit? Moore's Law is based on electrons and transistors, right? Ones and zeros, ones and zeros. Qubits use quantum theory. It's not one and zero. It's anything between one and zero. So you can now compute using gradations from one to zero. And think about that for water quality or any kind of model. And they said, well, yeah, this isn't quite ready for commercial development yet. And the investigator said, yeah, we think it's going to take another year or so before it comes online. I said, geez, another year or so, that's pretty good. So always try to anticipate what's coming in terms of processing and stuff. You can't calibrate a highly resolved model. Right? We hear this all the time. You can build this glamorous model that predicts all this intricate behavior, but you can't calibrate. Calibration in the traditional sense of, we go out and collect a water sample at a given place and time, we compare it against the model output, and we do that, you know, repeat as necessary, and try to get a, you know, reduced mean square error kind of thing. Well, what about if you have a hydrodynamic model, which they have now, that are so finely resolved that they're picking out, or they're predicting, or they're simulating things like eddies and currents and fronts that aren't in the model, that evolve from the resolution scale of the model. So what about if you think about maybe your resolution, or maybe your calibration is not so much comparing measurements to model predictions, but talking to the fishermen who come around and go, yeah, I come around that point every morning and there's always a front set up there. That's the way this system works. Or there's an eddy that comes around that point. So the hydrodynamic models are already starting to be calibrated, and granted it's much more qualitative, but it's kind of, yeah, that's what the system does. That's the way it looks. So we have to think maybe more about what calibration really means in that sense. One of the things that I just kind of throw out is, I don't know how to do this, but it seems that a lot of other things in our world now are self-learning. That is, you do something on the internet, it sort of figures out what you're trying to do, and it helps you, or it tries to sell you something. You know, if you're like Google something, and then you decide not to buy it, you know, for the next 3 weeks you get prompts to go to this website to buy something. What if we had, some way to hook up water quality models with real-time observations of chlorophyll or, whatever, pick it, and have those two things work together in real-time and calibrate the models that way? Self-correct, self-learn the models. I agree with the sense that, you can't hire someone to sit down with a spreadsheet of model projections and a spreadsheet of observations and try to figure out the model projection. That's not going to work. But we've got to think of other ways of doing it. Sediment transport is too hard. I don't think it's too hard. I think we just have to do it. And nobody understands complex models. Right? And I'd only point to you, the last point is, Pixar Studios. When you or your community or stakeholders go to the movies and see a Pixar movie, they don't really care there's 10 million lines of code behind it and it's not real. They want to know that it's authentic and it seems like, it makes sense to them. So maybe our idea of, not everyone in the room in a often contentious kind of situation will ever understand all the complexity of a model. Well, but do they understand the output? So they understand the results, they understand where it came from. I think that the area of visualization and thinking about how the models are presented to the stakeholders in the general population is one ripe for discussion. So I'll just end on the slide. It's got my contact information on it. I would like to thank all of you for the invitation, and hopefully we have time for questions. And however, I guess I'll turn it back to Jean, and she can take it from here. So thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. We do have a number of questions that have been submitted online, and we'll continue to build that queue up. So if you're streaming the audio online, you can click the question mark icon at the top if you haven't done so and type up a question or comment very quickly. We'll get that in. I know that we do have participants on the phones, but before we turn to them, Kira, are there any questions physically in the room with the live audience?
No pressure. Please. I have one. This is the first time. I remember talking with Larry Burkhardt about some of our PCB, our web model, and I was looking at already. One of the ideas he brought up was that even amongst the particles about strength of binding, like
yes,
not just among the classes, but within, you know, I wonder your thoughts on that, your model is like.
Yeah, so the question from here in Seattle was about on partitioning of PCBs, bioaccumulation of PCBs. The question is whether there's one way to think of this is that each particle has different strengths of binding, as opposed, I guess, or maybe to complement the idea that different particles have different strengths.
Yes,
yeah.
One particle might have preferences.
Yeah, so I think that the in theory, I mean, we know that different types of particles have different binding strengths, and that's given. We also know not so much for PCBs and things that are sort of non-specific adsorbers, but certainly metals and other things. In catalysis literature, there's lots of literature on some types are more preferentially absorbing than others. Fortunately, that's kind of an academic question. Modeling-wise, you need a lot of different sites in your model, site strengths, and whether they're physically on different particles. Well, I guess it's quite academic. If there are different particles and those different particles are settling at different rates, then you need to keep track of that. I'm going to take that back. For PCBs and things of that nature, I'm not sure that there really would be much differential preference for different sites on particles. So, despite what you learn in grad school in Stum and Morgan, most solids in the real world are covered with slime. And you're really looking at partitioning under the slime. Joan.
This is Joan Hardy. My question is a practical one. Are you at the point now where the information you got from the models will inform cleanup activities? For example, the Duwamish, they're talking about the regenerative cleanup sediment. So this information that actually there would be bioavailable results.
So let me repeat the question for those on the phone. Joan Hardy from the State Department of Health here in Washington State. And the question is, how do we take results from our modeling and measurements as well and inform cleanup operations that are kind of happening now? And that's a great question, and frankly, I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to come talk to you. And it's a difficult conversation because you don't want to. Some of these processes have been going on for a long time, and there's a process, and the last thing you want to do is be throwing in new ideas in the middle of a process. Having said that, it's always a process, right? So when do you have that conversation? One of my windmills to tilt out, which I gave up on in the Hudson a long time ago, is if we find some way to take some of these sites and use part of them or all of them as experimental areas and learn something from the remediation activity. Now, our results in the Hudson, and that study wasn't particularly brilliant, we just did it, was confirmed when they started dredging, that's about how much dissolved PCB we saw released from the site. So it was entirely predictable. How you get ahead of that, I think we need to model. I think we need, as a community, we need to not be working on the models that are currently being used in contentious
situations, but to be building the next generation of models that will be used in the next series of contentious. but there is that tension. How do you jump in, or when do you jump in? Thanks for the question. I'm not getting involved in the dynamics. So, other questions? So I think we're ready for you, Gene.
Okay, great. I'm going to start with those of you participating via the phone lines. So if you're on the telephone and have a question, you'll need to unmute. The command to unmute is *6. If you've used your own local mute button, you may have to turn that off as well. But as long as that's been disabled, hit *6, and we'd ask that you identify either yourself or organization before asking your question. Okay, well, with that, I'm going to go ahead and start reading through some of these online questions, and we'll take a moment before we close to turn back to the phones. But this first question is coming in from Oregon's DEQ out in Portland, and they ask, are the results you discussed on PCB releases from resuspension published? If so, are they available? How can I get a copy?
Yes, I sure apologize. I should have had a list of references. Is there a way for me to send, for you to send the bibliography to the...
Yep.
Okay.
You can pass along to us, and we'll post on the resource page for the seminar.
Okay, I will do that. The work that was on the Hudson River work was published in Environmental Science and Technology, and I'll get you the exact reference. Abby Schneider was the lead author on it, and it was probably maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but I'll send you the exact reference for that. That work has been published.
Okay, thank you. Our next question comes from the Department of Energy in Germantown, Maryland, and they ask, do you utilize high-performance computing, or HPC, or do you interact with modelers at the Department of Energy's national laboratories, for example, the Advanced Scientific Computing Research, ASCR?
I do not, and I would love to, and I think this is a point that I meant to make earlier, and I keep sounding like an old guy here, but here we go again. Back in the day, the people doing the science, I mean, people like me, the environmental chemists doing the lab work, doing the field work, could figure out enough about the computers to do our own modeling. Those days are gone. all this stuff, particularly trying to integrate data streams and all things I don't even know about. We need better partnerships with groups like the one that were just mentioned. There's a lot of disciplines, a lot of industries around that use really high-end computer power. And I think we're just not accessing that in water quality modeling, and we should be. It's a little odd that, like, atmospheric models do, even air quality models do to a large extent. And I think it's because they need it. Air quality models never really quite got to the point of the simple, right? There was no corollary to the 1980s air quality model, because they could never get secondary organic aerosols right in a variety of living. So they had to keep pushing until they got better. So they're still engaged. I think we, on the water quality side, we got a tool in place that works pretty well, a lot of stuff. And our challenge now is to engage the computer science information technology community better. And I would say that's a university problem as much as it is a government or contractor problem as well. We don't train students in environmental sciences that understand computers well enough to use them for anything other than simple models that they download, spreadsheets, and check in Facebook.
Well, actually, along those lines, we have a similar statement and question that came in from Arlington, Virginia. And they ask, haven't some advances been made in computing modeling? Back in the early 2000s, I was working on projects for groundwater modeling programs that took advantage of supercomputing and applied parallel processing to groundwater models with analytical methods. With that increased IT power, we were able to do much more, model larger areas, like entire lake basins, at much finer resolutions than we'd ever done before.
Yes, I would agree with that statement. And again, I think there's been a divergence in my personal opinion is that certain types of modeling have remained in closer contact with the new developments in computer technologies than others. And I think it would be an interesting kind of case study to figure out why certain disciplines have followed that track and others haven't. But yeah, mm-hmm.
if people have groups or computing parties that they'd like to introduce you to, for example, the Department of Energy group, can we refer them to contact you via email?
Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. No, go ahead, Doctor.
No, I was just going to say, and they should know, well, I'll stop there, never mind. I was going to say they should contact EPA program officers, too, that support that kind of work. A blatant commercial, sorry.
Nothing wrong with those. I'm going to go ahead to the next question I have online. This is an anonymous question, but they asked, how does temperature impact resuspension or partitioning rates of PCBs, especially in extremely cold northern coastal estuaries?
Wow, that's a really good question. So temperature affects so many different things. It's hard to give you a general answer. So a couple things pop into mind immediately. You know, the colder you get, the slower, the fewer bugs you have and the slower they're working. So bioturbation, all those things that affect the physics of the sediment layer would change. In the water column, the desorption rates of the PCB would of course slow down, but diffusion being quite temperature dependent. But I would actually think, it's off the top of my head, is the main impact in colder areas is going to be sort of secondary in the sense of affecting the density and activity of the benthic organisms that oftentimes control the relationship between the erosion rates and the resuspension material.
Okay, great. I'm going to go ahead and turn back to see if anybody on the telephone lines has a question or perhaps has raised enough courage to go off of mute and ask a question out loud. Remember, it's *6 to locally unmute using our mute command. And feel free to identify yourself and organization. Okay, I don't see any other questions that have been submitted online, so I'll turn things back to those of you in the room for one last chance for questions.
I think we're good here.
All right, fantastic. Well, if there are no further questions in the room, online or not, I'll go ahead and begin the formal closeout for the online broadcast. And so with that, I'm going to direct everybody's attention past link number or the link slide, which was slide 61, and move you along to slide number 62, which is our thank you slide. As we mentioned earlier when we started today's session, there is a short feedback form that we will ask if you take just a minute to let us know what you thought of today's session. We do read each and every one of the forms, and that's the way we can continue to improve what we do here at CLUIN and offer sessions like this online. So I know that our organizers out there at the University of Washington, as well as colleagues at EPA Region 10 and myself here in EPA DC, would very much so appreciate it if you could take just a moment to follow the link on slide 62 to fill out the feedback form. If you're not at a computer with internet access, that very same link to the feedback form is available on the seminar homepage, and it's active indefinitely, so you can go back and fill the form out later on today, tomorrow, or even next week. I would indicate, though, that if you're looking if you share the line with multiple parties and each person wants to submit their own feedback form, when you fill out the form, there'll be another link that appears that'll allow someone else to fill out their own copy of the form. While we don't issue CEUs or PDHs here on CLUIN, we do offer a confirmation email after you fill out feedback. So when you're filling out that form, there's a box you can check that's sort of circled in red on slide 62. And as long as your email address is entered incorrectly, you'll have a confirmation message emailed to you to keep for your own records. That, along with your registration email and a copy of the slides, may be enough to get you credit with your accrediting institution if you do need CEUs or PDHs. There's an indicator as well on slide 62 that if you have follow-up questions or comments regarding the presentation you saw today, to reach out to Katie Frevert, the University of Washington Superfund Research Program. She's the program manager out there. Her email address as well as telephone number, again, are shown on slide 62. And the final slide, everyone, speaking of free commercials earlier, I'll direct you to slide 63, which is just a short commercial for us here on CLUIN. At the Cleanup Information Network, we do try our very hardest to stay connected with practitioners and professionals in environmental cleanup programs. So we do have a website that's publicly available. We have tons and tons of resources out there. We host free online sessions like this every day. And if you'd like to stay engaged or connect with us, you are certainly welcome to follow us on our Facebook page, our Twitter account, or even join our LinkedIn group and discuss items or show us resources that you think are helpful. So with that, I'm going to continue to extend the thanks around. I want to send it back out to the organizers there from the University of Washington Superfund Research Program. Thank you so very much for taking the time to put together today's session. I want to thank my colleagues out in EPA Region 10, Kira Lynch, for helping to bring the session over to us at Kluwen, as well as Justin Crane for helping to offer support at today's session, and a number of other individuals, again, at the University of Washington who helped put together our seminar today. I want to thank the over 80 people who joined us from all over the country with the live online broadcast. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. Again, today's session was recorded, and you will automatically receive an email from me as soon as that free recording is available to download or replay. And at that time, you'll be welcome to forward it on to any colleagues that you think will find it valuable. Thank you all so very much for joining us today, and I hope that I'll see you or hear from you on a future Kluwen seminar. Take care. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.